Greetings everyone, and welcome to another RLM-centric presentation. This being DRAW-RLM-005. And I am known as Craig. I'm going to begin this episode twice. The segment you are listening to now is an introduction to the following reading or audiobook type recording of a text entitled Pee in a Cup. The word pee spelled here as P-E-A for clarity's sake. Beforehand though, some brief notes of interest. Once again, I'd like to remind you all of the donation button that is found on the front page of the reallibertymedia.com website. Please do consider showing your support to keep the content various content creators provide available at present and into the future. Should you be able to, that is. Remember, the only insignificant donation made was the one that wasn't made at all. Moving on, the best place to find non-fraudulent links to my own presence online would be my Linktree page. Should you perform a web search with the terms Linktree and Art of Craig S, spelled A-R-T underscore O-F underscore C-R-A-I-G underscore S, you should be able to find it. As well, I can be reached directly at artofcraigs@protonmail.com. That's ARTOFCRAIGS, all one word, @protonmail.com. Returning to the heart of this presentation, written in 1999 and now in its silver jubilee year, Pee in a Cup by one known as Antonio Vacchi is the text I'll be reading from. To further flesh out this introduction, I want to share with you that there was a point in time I didn't necessarily possess the vocabulary nor the foundational conceptual framework to be able to articulate explicit experience I have had to others, but I think I can do so better now. I mention all this because it's clear to me that the Holy Spirit has put it upon me to search out such material for decades and decades now, such as, but certainly not limited to, the upcoming text I shall be reading from. I'm sure some of you out there can relate to this inner compulsion to do so, in spite of the consequences. I'll give you an example of an odd signifier, the type that I usually experience, that has and does continue to propel me on my journey. A coincidence, one might say, particularly in relation to the upcoming text I'll be reading from. Some of you out there will get the picture. You see, when I was in college, I had these compulsory humanities courses to take, and I found them to be quite fascinating. So much so, at times, I wonder if I had missed my calling in not having pursued being an instructor concerning such topics. My then classmates, however, certainly were not enthralled by the topics discussed in the least, and usually just did whatever they had to do in order to pass these types of courses, notwithstanding that it wasn't part of their own major, that is. One such course was called In Search of the Good Society. The instructor referenced many profound ideas and ideologies over the course of the semester. One day in class, he actually attempted to offer a warning to us students about something. Much to the guffaws of my fellow classmates, their short-sightedness the cause of my own chagrin. What the instructor had done was, he had held up a print magazine to the class. It was an old issue of Ciné Fantastique magazine. He was holding it in such a way as to display the centerfold poster. He was slowly panning the open magazine, held aloft, in order that everyone in the room could see it. And as he did so, he repeated the following a few times. This is your future, if you're not careful, if you don't pay attention. As he slowly turned towards my direction, I could then see that the fold-out poster was from the 1987 film RoboCop. A personal memory that stayed with me, so much so I can recount it to you now. That day in that class had always struck me as a bit odd. What is the significance of all this in relation to the upcoming reading, you may be wondering? The significance is that Mr. Vacchi's text, or in it, I should say, he cites that very film as a reference. as pertaining to a policy-based state, or put another way, a police state. I don't believe in coincidences. I find it to be quite serendipitous that this film was released just over 200 years after the contract between the then King of England and the then 13 United States of North America in 1783. Alexander Tyler, a Scottish history professor at the University of Edinburgh, has been cited as making a comment around the time that that aforementioned contract was substantiated. A comment concerning the fate of the Athenian Empire of ancient Greece. Quote, "The average age of the world's greatest civilizations from the beginning of history has been about 200 years. During those 200 years, those nations always progressed through the following 8-step sequence. 1. From bondage to spiritual faith. 2. From spiritual faith to great courage. 3. From courage to liberty. 4. From liberty to abundance. 5. From abundance to complacency. 6. From complacency to apathy. 7. From apathy to dependence. And last but not least, from dependence back into bondage." Unquote. I'll pursue this idea further by coupling it with the 5 regimes as discussed in the philosophical work written by Plato entitled Republic. Plato here observes these types of political regimes in history. These are commonly referred to, as you may have guessed, as Plato's 5 regimes. Those being, from best to worst, 1. Aristocracy, 2. Democracy, 3. Oligarchy, 4. Democracy, and 5. Tyranny. Plato also said these 5 political regimes are prone to degenerating into the next, forming a circular pattern, although not necessarily in a sequential fashion. It seems to me the West, so-called, has begun to metamorphose into tyranny, or that of a police state. What played out during COVID-19, so-called, as I had presented in DRAWRLM004, would be a great resource to support this argument. When I merged those previous observations from Mr. Tyler the historian and Plato the philosopher, I for one start to see certain other patterns emerging relevant to our time. It would seem at some point the bondage state of tyrannical servitude, where little to no accountability is to be found for those who have taken or presently hold such oaths of office, in addition to little to no redress from harm for the plebeian, denizen, debt slave citizen, underscores this notion in our present time. Remember what the instructor of In Search of the Good Society had said, quote, "This is your future, if you're not careful, if you don't pay attention," unquote. To move some other ideas further along, I'm going to combine the true form of aristocracy, unlike what we observe today, and the concept of spiritual faith as a departure point for the following observation I'd like to propose to you, the listener, to consider. In concerning potential outcomes, I see that society may metamorphose yet again further, possibly to that of an aristocracy. Perhaps an aristocracy where Christ Jesus, in the literal sense, or in the figurative sense, that is to say the sense of being a foundation in the minds of the populace, an aristocracy where in either case he truly fulfills his place as the Prince of Peace, or better described as the King of Kings, as stated in Revelation 17:14, quote, "These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called chosen and faithful," unquote. With events such as they are today, I'm not entirely convinced that we are in the end times, so-called, per se. By the by, I, for one, am very fortunate that I chose to make time in my life to reinvestigate this asymmetrical book of spiritual law, tweaking and extending this notion that the Bible, as being an important book at any time, let alone at this time, to familiarize oneself with, if not already, from what I can see. I refer to it as asymmetrical, because even though assuredly you can't have the Old without the New Testament, or vice versa, with the New Testament being of a shorter duration, containing the advent of Christ Jesus, I understand as being the core, or noyau, as the French word for core goes. I'll also include another peculiar quality as to why I state it is an asymmetrical book. I think that that aforementioned quality intentionally reflects that of the naturally asymmetrical composition of a capital letter M, capitonym, man. The connection I'm attempting to make here being, as we are living beings, the wisdom of the scriptures comes from a living God, as it has been referred to as a living book, of an asymmetrical composition, much like ourselves. Was that all too much word salad-like for you? I hope not. And continuing upon the topics of oppression in general, along with the wisdom contained within the scriptures, as I had also stated in DRAW RLM 004, nothing has changed in 2,000 years or so. As Christ Jesus had warned in Matthew 16:6, quote, "Then Jesus said unto them, Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees," unquote. He also warned us when he said in Revelation 2:9, quote, "I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich, and I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan," unquote. I think the issue goes beyond one particular so-called group of people. From what I have gathered thus far, all these world religions, that is to say the heads of them, leaders of industry, banking dynasties, and royal families of the world, they're all working together at the upper levels of society, I think. That which is described, actually, in Revelation 17:5, quote, "And upon her forehead was written a name, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth," unquote. I think that this mystery, Babylon the Great, represents all of those groups operating in unison. Unbeknownst to the vast majority of their supporters, or detractors for that matter, working together as purveyors of all that is not conducive to life, that is to say, not conducive to God's creation. Even so, whatever these people are doing, what about the rest of us? Us plebeian, denizen, debt slaves, citizens on the monad or individual level. What I'm getting at here are the unhealthy impulses that we all possess, that these groups encourage in one way or another, and spiritual forces that use these unfortunate, innate, fallen qualities against us, that manifest in the forms of lust, anger, and greed. This is addressed in a few instances in the Bible, for example. In Ephesians 6:12, quote, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places," unquote. Naturally, prayer, fasting, and Bible study will give you the guidance needed to overcome such wickedness in your own life, including having the horse sense to defend your rights in an administrative capacity, legalistically speaking. I say that because that is about all we have left. There is no way an individual nor group can ever possibly amass greater arms than the state can mobilize at this point in time. And that might not even be required, for a few reasons. One citation I'll include here is that from Matthew Henry's Commentary on the Bible, where he addresses what Christ Jesus had said in Matthew chapter 5, verse 44, concerning praying for one's enemies, a challenge to be sure. Quote, "See how it is cleared by the command of the Lord Jesus, who teaches us another lesson. As Christ said, but I say unto you, I, who come to be the great peacemaker, the general recounselor, who loved you when you were strangers and enemies, I say, love your enemies." From verse 44. Though men are ever so bad themselves and carry it ever so basely towards us, yet that does not discharge us from the great debt we owe them of love to our kind, love to our kin. We cannot but find ourselves very prone to wish the hurt, or at least very coldly to desire the good of those that hate us and have been abusive to us. But that which is at the bottom hereof is a root of bitterness, which must be plucked up, and a remnant of corrupt nature which grace must conquer." Unquote. Nevertheless, before I veer way too far off the main points of this introduction to Mr. Vacci's work, that I'll be reading for your listening pleasure and edification, I'll return to the main thrust of this presentation with the following. The astute of you out there listening to the following reading, or if you were to read this document for yourself, will not fail to notice the many allusions to the wisdom of the scriptures contained therein, especially in part 5, such as the warning from Christ Jesus as found in Luke 11:46, quote, "And he said, Woe unto you also, ye lawyers, for ye laid men with burdens grievous to be borne, and ye yourselves touch not the burdens with one of your fingers." Unquote. Some allusions are more apparent, such as what Christ Jesus had said in the New Testament in John 17:11 and 14-15. Quote, "I have given them thy word, and the world hath hated them, because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from evil." Unquote. I'd like to include briefly my relation to this text by this enigmatic Mr. Vacci, which began in 2020 or so when I had first read it. To an extent, it had stayed with me since. I had sought out this text when I had heard reference to it several times from RLM's very own Hal Anthony on his Behind the Woodshed broadcast. The original site that I found it upon has long since been sanitized of its original contents. However, you can still find it at the following link I'll recite that will take you to the archive.org Wayback Machine version, because as far as I know, that is the only way to find it. The link is https://redduced.to/xcw4c. I certainly claim no rights to the text, nor did anyone ask me to do this, nor am I doing so to steal anyone's thunder, nor ride on their coattails, nor to self-aggrandize myself. I'm quite surprised no one else had done so sooner. In preparing for this reading, I did have to pre-plan somewhat my approach as to how I was going to do so. I say that because there are many instances of quotation marks around words within the text purposefully put there to denote that something had a sardonic or ulterior meaning. Additionally, I had only emphasized quotation marks when another resource was being directly quoted from by the author. Similarly, there were quite a bit of instances of odd usage of exclamation marks and question marks. I imagine to intentionally punctuate the significance of certain portions of the text, I decided to keep the theatrics to a minimum. I did emphasize certain words as seen from the page itself. I did so in a way so as not to lose the significance of what I could glean was the author's intent. In a sense, it is a document that has to be read with one's own eyes. There were some instances of the use of slang to which I just read the words as they appeared. The text is focused on the US of A so-called, to be sure. However, anywhere one might find the rule of law in effect, such as in other jurisdictions as Quebec, Canada, or even the UK, the same premise basically applies. I actually had to record the reading twice, since toward the conclusion of the first take, my voice began to crack. Not from exhaustion, rather because I became a bit choked up, with tears welling up in my eyes as I began to think about what it was I was reading over that of the recitation itself. To think, if only such works as this, which was written in 1999, had garnered more attention, that the populace of such jurisdictions had stood up for themselves then, we might not be in the precarious condition we are in now, given this is 25 years later in 2024. Keep in mind, this was written before the shot across the bow to World War III of the Ship of State on September 11th, 2001. This was written before the rise of the police state in the West sometime in March of 2020. We have arrived at the zenith of it all. It's not an ending though, it's a new beginning. Having said all of that, I want to thank you all for having taken the time to listen to this, as well as my other RLM-centric audio presentations. I also want to thank the staff at RLM for having extended the invitation and opportunity for me to do so. Once you hear the truth, you cannot unhear it, friend and foe alike. These presentations have been a compressed series of resources for you to begin your own journey in truth with, be it the wisdom of the scriptures or untangling the word trickery of legalism. To reiterate, the intent for these presentations being produced was to inspire you to do your own due diligence, to take proper action, not improper action. With that, you might be better able to draw your own conclusions. Fair use disclaimer. Under Section 107 of the Copyright Act of 1976, allowance is made for fair use for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, and research. Fair use is a use permitted by copyright statute that might otherwise be infringing. Educational use tips the balance in favor of fair use. Pee in a Cup, written, researched, and experienced by Antonio Vacci, 1999 AD, parts 1 to 5 in its totality. Read by Craig S. in the summer of 2024 AD, Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Part 1 of Pea in a Cup by Antonio Vacchi. This can't be true, for crying out loud. Your head pounds in disbelief as you see the truth in the words, quote, "The ORS, or statutory law, is private bar association law, and not the law of the people," unquote. This is evidenced by the copyright in the title page of these now mere corporate bylaws, as law, not real law, mere police, or policy. This is a serious revelation. But how can that be? How is it possible? When? If it can be shown that the Bar Association controls the law and its administration, then it sits as an occupying force over our territory. This must be exposed and overthrown, or we the people shall surely succumb to the badge of servitude known as human resource or voluntary slavery. This is so under international common law concerning occupations. The question now, if this is true, is it too late? But before you get on your horse to make your ride, there must be a glimpse of proof of this occupation. Before you declare, "The British are here," "No, the British have been here," you must have more proof. Is the ship of corporate state really in the harbor? Has a foreign occupying force silently and cunningly taken over your state and land? Surely you are insane to advance such an alarm without proof. If true, the alarm must surely sound. But where to find this proof? Go to the source, you think. The Oregon Revised Statutes, ORS, contain a construction chapter. Maybe you'll find something there. A foreign corporation? Ah, yes. Your hunch is correct. At quote, ORS 174.510.1. The statute laws set forth after Section 8 of Enrolled House Bill No. 2 of the 47th Legislative Assembly were enacted as law of the State of Oregon, effective December 31st, 1953, unquote. You see here that the statute laws are as law. Can you say territory occupation? You also notice 174.520, General Statutes enacted prior to January 12, 1953, repealed, exceptions. 1. All statute laws of Oregon, of a general, public, and permanent nature enacted prior to January 12, 1953, were repealed effective December 31st, 1953. Not so permanent, were they? Yes, also you see the bylaws are set forth after HB 2. But what is HB 2? A computer search suggests only one piece of information. It tells you that HB 2 was called the Model Business Corporation Act. You find yourself at the State Archives building in Salem, Oregon, asking for help on this query. Nothing turns up concerning the act under that name, so you inquire of HB 2 and the laws prior. The archivist explains that prior to 1953, the records of government activity are inconsistent. After 1953, the books and records are complete. The archivist explains how to look for HB 2. He brings you the bill file folder for the year in question. You find HB 2 as the second bill in the folder. It is an immense work of legalese measuring about an inch thick. You sit and read this, securing in your mind the reason for your research. Proof of a foreign occupation. An invasion. After hours of reading, and your mind now numb, it doesn't seem to make sense. What does this bill have to do with the ORS? This law was put into the ORS of 1953, so you go to those volumes and find HB 2 codified at Chapter 57, Foreign Corporation. Foreign Corporation! What on earth can this have to do with the law of the people? Curious, you get the current edition of the ORS as laws and look for Chapter 57. You see that in the current bylaws, Chapter 57 has been renumbered, then repealed. Okay, so where did it go? Substituted law. Returning to the construction statutes of the ORS, you find the most compelling proof since finding that the ORS is the law and or by law and or as law and or policy of a foreign corporation that has been secreted upon you. This proof is at ORS 174.550, Statute Revision of 1953, substituted for statutes repealed by ORS 174.520. The provisions of the statute laws described in ORS, quote, 174.510, 1, are considered as substituted in a continuing way for the provisions of the prior statute laws repealed by ORS 174.520, unquote. Substituted law. And look closely, it isn't even substituted. It really is as substituted. Just like your money, it is not money specie. It works merely as money. It is corporate debt scrip. As money legal tender. You can't believe what you are reading. The law of the people as substituted for the policy of a foreign corporation. In this scam, the bar cleverly moves the substituted pea to yet another cup, pouring it out as legitimate drink for consumption by the hand-fed people. And as if by magic, the law of the people, in their consuming stupor, disappears. The Bar Association authorized the lawfulness of which is held questionable through prior constitutional amendment has overtaken the people and their self-governing state of the state of Oregon with a mere state called Oregon. See the definition of in the state. Occupied? This occupying force, pursuant to international common laws governing territorial occupation, arguably took the law as it found them in the occupied territory and using those laws altered the governance of the now occupied people. The servant and subject is you, and each of you, and yours. And because you threw it off not, the yoke of the beast is your burden. You cannot claim to be free, suffering this adultery to freedom. The law now requires all your attention to overthrow the oppressor, or the last nail penetrates the coffin. You remember this totalitarian and tyrannical condition being reflected in the movie RoboCop, minus the special effects. Oregon is run by privateering corporate police and can be considered in all respects a police state. This is true for every state in the Union. The corporation called State of Oregon, all capital letters, is simply the most blatant and arrogant about this. Officials will tell you that what is written is state law, but what the lawyers write is really mere policy. A policy state. This policy contrivance is made more clear, for example, in driver license requirements. This requirement is just social policy and not a requirement under real law, and no requirement can be found. The Constitution, a document creating a limited governance does not give to the state or federal jurisdiction power to force an association to do what by necessity you already naturally do. In fact, forced associations are prohibited by the law of the land. If there be a living constitution today, that indicates we exist politically in a policy state. All you must do is change the letter Y in policy for the letter E to observe the real state, a police state. Can you see clearly now? Law and freedom dies in an occupation. It becomes just us, not you. In this case, the lawyers and the judges of the Bar Association run the show now. As they have said over and over again, it is their courtroom. Can you believe it now? You may not believe this is the fact, but they aren't kidding. The only question now is, do you continue to put up with this arrogance and inequitable inequality? Do you intend to exist in a truly free state? But how did this police state come about? How about the state of confusion? Pee in a cup. Just like the old shell game where you are to choose which cup holds the pee, the initiators of the Foreign Corporations Law, which implement the current ORS, slipped Chapter 57 quietly and unobtrusively into Chapter 60, Private Domestic Corporation. They then repealed all that was remaining of Chapter 57. Sounds like a legal sleight of hand deftly manipulating which cup holds the pee. But you are curious now as your mind's eye strains to keep track. Who is holding the cup? Whose pee is it? Where is the pee going? Returning home to your computer search, which indicated that HB2 was a Model Business Corporation Act, you read more closely to see who submitted the act for legislative approval. You finally find the instigator. The purpose of HB2 did not fill any real need of the people or any one of them. It is the tool of none other than the Bar Association. Then once officially in the state, the industrious bar, through legislative manipulation, slid foreign corporation law under the cover of private domestic corporation law. The ORS is set forth after, under the authority of HB2, a model act for foreign corporate business whose sole beneficial activity is political takeovers. The only authoring or interest entity behind that bill, HB2, was and is the Bar Association. You are astonished. In researching this further, you find out that the pee will be hid in a new cup very shortly. Apparently, the lawyer legislators, legislative council, feel that the Bar Association is too high profile and the people are slowly ferreting out the facade, so the members are conspiring to hide it where nobody will see it. The best place will be right under the nose of the people. It will be assimilated into the Supreme Court. This way, it is out of sight, out of mind, and absolutely insulated from direct accountability. And this is one of the best of their underhanded tricks yet. Lawyers and judges have figured out how they can occupy your life unto its destruction, and you cannot hold them accountable. In fact, the racketeer's hold is so strong and absolute that one judge will protect another without a flinch of conscience. You have seen this before, where the federal court gives absolute immunity to judges and district attorneys. Remember, members of the bar, pursuant to their oath before admission, are not to allow shame to befall the brotherhood, especially the shame connected with their conspiracy, theft, and pirateering. So much for your right of redress of grievance. But then again, There are no such rights under a corporate police, just privileges. Remember? Now that you can see this, do you wonder how you can let them get away with this? For now, you find compelling too the knowledge that the bar originates in England, a private development corporation there. Is this enough proof, though? You figure it won't hurt to check a couple of other things before confirming the pee in the cup. End of part one of Pee in a Cup by Antonio Vacci. Part two of Pee in a Cup by Antonio Vacci. Feeling preoccupied? In the last part, you journeyed the proof that through sleight of hand, law has been, as substituted, for the private policy of a foreign corporation rendering our existence to that of a police state, unoccupied people. This part will explore the ramifications of that fact. The Newer Deal, Comply or Die. The United States and Oregon appear to be a work and or penal colony. See The New Deal, 1933, and ORS 285A.171. A benchmark is hereby established, quote, to yield a high return on human investment, including but not limited to greater worker productivity and future monetary savings, unquote. Isn't that a comforting thought? You are considered a financial beast of burden. That mammal, the human resource of at least one foreign development corporation whose only colonial purposes, since as far back as 1610 AD, have been for profit and economic development at the pleasure, letters patent, and insistence of the Crown of England. Don't you feel special? All this development is protected by field officer operatives of the empire called members of the bar, holding the feudal rank of esquire. Remember you read the proof of this imperialist plot near the Capitol steps in Salem, Oregon. Quote, westward the star of empire takes its way, unquote. And it seems so. For the most part, the Bar Association and its members, esquire, instigate, create, make, enforce, and administer, or force, policy as law. This counterfeit law controls, to an unreasonable degree, through another policy, that of compliance through aggressive enforcement, the life of the people. You are struck with the realization that this occupation, though not unknown, is unparalleled in history. A bar order opposed to freedom unless it says so. A police state. A state of occupation. Where, in the Newer Deal, any seeking or expecting freedom are aggressively imposed upon to comply or die. Don't laugh, it's a bad yoke. Indeed, there has and can be discovered ample proof of the oppression. The Newer Deal, a life absent abundance producing the highest yield. This condition admits defeat to a worldly bondage under an industrious Crown Development Corporation of barristers called the International Bar Association. The Crown taking America by its BA. Can you say KY2? Is that revolting, or should you be? It is up to you. Do you choose to live absolutely compliant in one of the United States of occupation? Or stand up belligerently as required by law to cast off this profanity? It is time for spiritual perseverance and an ouster of this enemy of freedom and light, this bar to life. Will you now wake from your slumber and stand, becoming a spiritual warrior after truth, freedom, and a truly American way? Cast off the evil, this defiler of all that is good. It isn't funny, it's a bad yoke. The people suffer exceedingly. since the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States had not been ratified by the state of Oregon, the state, you can find no authorization for a legal entity or association not having, like rights, of the people power to submit for approval to the Legislative Assembly anything, i.e., HB 2, 1953. A viable potential may be Article 7, amended, of the Constitution of the State of Oregon. However, your fact-finding indicates that that article is obscured in its own mystery. This mystery, interestingly enough, ties you back to the problems you find yourself investigating here. The deception by the Bar Association upon the people and of that article is great. Among the most notable problems with respect to this quest for proof of an occupation is that Article 7, amended, restricts judgeships to members of the bar. You note, consequentially, this legal fiction, the Bar Association, is sole beneficiary of this will of the people. Sounds like a conflict of interest, doesn't it? You cannot find this bar membership qualification in the original Constitution. Anyone before could be a judge. And this purported will of the people is of contention, as it cannot be shown without some questionable circumstance that Article 7, amended, is a lawful amendment duly enacted by the people. But because the bar is in control, this will never come to issue. Investigating the International Bar Association, IBANnet.org, explains this most thoroughly through the statement that this association will aggressively protect, pursuant to UN protocol and directive, its interests globally. In fact, as you read, you realize that the International Bar Association and all member bars are the legal arm of the United Nations. Now, how is it the bar can globally make policy as law if the United States of America was to be the singular expression and example of independence and freedom? If the bar can make global policy and foist it upon our people, then that policy isn't law respecting the aspiration contained in the preamble of this once independent, a preeminent nation. Also not found challenged, and because of the prevailing bar never so, is the rightful authority, even of the people, to create what in effect is an antitrust violation allowing absolute monopoly by a mere illegal alien, a person not yet recognized in law, of the intimate departments in the people's own governance to the exclusion of the people themselves. In actuality, like all things that the Bar Association is connected with, Article 7, amended, appears to be another occupation foisted upon the people. Empowering State Bar Association legalness, HB 2, 1953, as well looks to be a violation of the Constitution of the State of Oregon, providing at Article 11, Section 2, quote, formation of corporations. Corporations may be formed under general laws, but shall not be created by the Legislative Assembly by special laws, unquote. The Bar Association sponsored HB 2, 1953. Appears to be a special law created by the Legislative Assembly dealing in the creation of a single foreign corporation, providing the basis for the Bar Association's monopoly of our lives. Prior to these amendments, any of the people, in good character and standing, could be a justice. The people before amendment had benefit of a judge chosen from all the numbers of their kind. The people were not forced, as now, to select from a few of an international brotherhood of private membership and private interest with a private social order. You see from this study that the people are currently prohibited from fulfilling this all-important duty of justice in their own court. Justice is vested in one self-serving, associated, foreign brotherhood. And you can verify these racketeering profiteers by the sojourn you make through a private bar court today, seeing the people suffer exceedingly. Under foreign private law, you conclude this suffrage has no remedy despite their promises to do justice. For what is mere justice without the foundation of law applied? How can remedy be had with assurance when the people are further subject to the caprice of a legislature under lobby pressures of still other corporations employing more bar members protecting their profiteering? Additionally, where is the security to the people in an oath forbidding shame befalling the brotherhood, but not the people? For when then is true accountability under a foreign private law? One more thing you note from your study of this foreign thorn. The amendment to Oregon Constitution, Article 7, includes the provision that the legislature can modify the Constitution at its whim. You note this would be a very powerful, albeit illegal, tool indeed for an occupying foreign force planning to secret themselves upon domestic shores at some future time. And so, it appears, is the case concerning the Bar Association and its encroachment and consequential effect over the property of the people. See the definition of in the state. You begin to understand why most undirected mail is sent to occupant, all capital letters. Since the power structuring between the bankers and lawyers provides securities to rape, pillage, plunder, and control the people, and each of them, continually, the occupying pirates take advantage by imposition, assuring compliance through aggressive enforcement. In other words, it is the newer deal. You will comply or die. Now are you feeling preoccupied? Or is it time to stand, giving others a sign informing them the time is now, and to come away from what occupies them? End of part 2 of Pea in a Cup by Antonio Vacci. Part 3 of Pea in a Cup by Antonio Vacci. The next CCC, a newer deal for the next millennium. As can be seen from part 2 of this article, living in an occupied state has its consequences, most certainly not truly beneficial. At some time prior, the state of the Union of Oregon ought to have been a union free of people in a whole state and not as a corporation, a free state of whole people joined together sharing welfare. This welfare concept reaches near perfection in the New Deal and the Civilian Conservation Corps, abbreviated as CCC, of 1935. Everybody works. You notice this subtle collectivist disclosure. Free state and or whole people, inscribed upon the marble at the entrance to the Capitol building in Salem, Oregon. This inscription in stone intends and rules as a commune guarding the shareholder benefit of welfare. It does not give notice that it serves a free people in a whole state, rather a free state of whole people. Subtle, aren't they? The corporate collective consequence. You read under corporations law that there are shareholders, those that have voting rights and those that don't. Under the corporate bylaws called ORS, every elector has a voting privilege as a shareholder if it can qualify. You think, this sounds quite democratic in a social fascist sort of way. What if you can't qualify? Do you die? This is certainly proof of the corporate collective consequence, abbreviated as CCC. Also, it is conveniently consistent with socialism from across the Atlantic. What happened to the choice of not voting and acting independently without the benefit of sharing welfare? What happened to free people exercising true independence? As you have seen, if it is not already apparent, freedom is not part of the perfected CCC Newer Deal for the next millennium. Statement on Case. In any extensive research on corporations, you've noticed the peculiar use of capitalization or case in words of legal documents you have read. Does capitalization really matter? What is the significance? A friend of yours, knowing of your research and this question, approaches you with a letter from the Secretary of State's office which, in paraphrase, says, quote, "The corporation's division disregards differences in upper and lower case. Our files list all legal entities in uppercase exclusively. This person you have requested information about is not in our records." Unquote. Another friend shows you a rule of the Oregon Court of Appeals. Quote, "Do not capitalize a word unless there is a reason to." Unquote. And another reference in the Local Bankruptcy Rules, LBR, 1005-1, petition captions which state in part, quote, "The caption of each petition shall include the debtor's full and correct name in capital letters." Unquote. So what does all this mean? Apparently you deduce this means that the name of an entity, legal, in person, created through act of law, not an act of God, is designated by all capital letters and is a person, corporate, or a mere legal entity. And the courts recognize this distinction, or purportedly so, and certainly in special proceedings, continuing receivership of the public bankruptcy since 1933. A legal entity exists in fictional places, i.e., O-R, C-A, O-H, etc., and is designated in improper form. That is why the state of Oregon, all capital letters, is spelled funny on the reverse of the title pages of the voluminous writing called the ORS. The state of Oregon, all capital letters, is pursuant to HB2 1953, a foreign corporation, and by implication of the various bylaws, habit, custom, and style standards, is by another name, a foreign holding corporation, also known as, aka, the Bar Association. A bankrupt corporation doing business as a charitable government in America over the land and waters of Oregon Territory called the State of Oregon. A title. The State of Oregon, all capital letters, is not entitled, but for the occupation. By the way, where in God's creation is the state of OR? And are you an act of law or an act of God? How do you spell your name? And where do you admit you exist? Who are you and where are you? Can you prove it? Look at your license or other utility bill in the state. If you can't make the appropriate proof of ID, a state of occupation will, as part of the current corporate collective, consequence. And what actually does ID mean? Didn't fraud call it an alter ego? Corporations keep records and make books. To your knowledge, you thought making books was illegal, but you remember something you read in HB2, 1953, and ORS, Chapter 57, 1953, that requires a corporation to keep records and make books of everything it does. You realize now that corporations, or all legal entities, are called a person, natural or otherwise, with designation of such class or status through capitalizing of the name. The state of Oregon, all capital letters, is a corporation having, like any corporation, peculiar legal requirements upon it, which are incidentally foreign to red-blooded American people. This foreign state is further confirmed by a friend who tells you that, pursuant to Federal Policy 26 U.S.C. 6001, quote, the Secretary of the Treasury shall determine a person liable for tax and order it to keep records and make books of the activity of the person, corporation, for income, return on profit invested, tax purposes, unquote. So why do you keep records and make books? A free people do not have the requirement to keep diligent activity records. A free people have no liability to account, however. Subjects are imposed upon sharing of the benefit of welfare, enjoying the servitude of taxation and bookmaking. The records kept by the people prior to 1953 were merely of the law in force which complies with common law notice requirements. Hence, you reason why it is that Oregon archives prior to 1953 are inconsistent. There was no corporate character to require the state of Oregon to keep records and make books. The foreign corporation law under foreign occupation statutes were not yet substituted as law in a continuing way. Now from part one, it becomes more clear what the archivist at Oregon State Archives was suggesting about records and books being consistent after 1953. After 1953, the State of Oregon, all capital letters, a bankrupt corporation, identified and designated so in the capitalized spelling, was required to keep records and make books of its corporate activities. That the corporation is an international foreign private entity doing charitable works and is entitled to exemption, or more aptly, exclusion, is of no matter. It is a creature of the law, deriving its existence and substance from the benefit of the law provided by the people. It would still be required to keep records and make books, even if masquerading as a government. It would need to account to the master, its creditor. In this case, the Bar Association, or more accurately, the fiscal agent for the State of Oregon, all capital letters, the Chase Manhattan Bank, all capital letters, in the Empire State, State of New York, all capital letters. Doesn't that surprise you? Remember, quote, westward the Star of Empire takes its way, unquote. Who do you really work for? Is all the foregoing proof continued in the first two parts of Pea in a Cup enough? If it is not, what would be adequate proof? You have seen in Bar Association courts of the State of Oregon, all capital letters, of foreign occupation, a criminal justice, and upon its altars of sacrifice, a people suffering conviction upon no facts or actual evidence. Victims purportedly convicted by the iota voting shareholder called juror or a tyrannical judge. These courts are a foreign adversarial arena made by the Bar Association Brotherhood and Temples of Abomination. A cult, occult, brotherhood that, in a moment's notice, through dutiful agents and officers, binds up, then sacrifices the lives, property, and families of those unfortunate, unsuspecting victims from the ranks of the people. Ultimately, who will you answer and pay tribute to? Who do you work for? If you are not outraged enough to throw off your oppressor, are you asleep? The Crown of Thorns. When you see evidence indicates the real intention behind the 3 Days' War of 1812, where the Crown of England sent troops merely to burn the Library of Congress, was to rid the crown of the evidence of a law prohibiting all titles of nobility and authorizing penalties, You see, what enabled the subsequent bar and banker invasion of this country after defaults of the prior engagements to the crown recognized in the Constitution? You have a new understanding of the function of the title of nobility, esquire, a feudal term, the rank of which is given to all attorneys in the Brotherhood. You notice that the Crown has had a long-time interest in stealthily creating an occupation of America and the people through corporate takeover. Your reading suggests that at that early time, debates in Parliament were of how best to conquer the Yanks. The fact then remained, war was costly and protracted. Besides, there was an easier way, economics. The banks would make an accounting of the debt, and the lawyers would preserve superiority and control through legal deception, intimidation, and wordsmithing, and the public government education system. To date, this crowning plan has been a total corporate raid and completely successful. The Parliament was right. War was protracted, and the Yanks could be taken an easier way. Economical development. Bearing the burden and the unpaid debt, the cross to bear. It appears the United States still owes the unpaid balance of the prior obligations to the Crown of England. The Crown is merely protecting its interest. Too bad, you think, those contracts weren't for kidneys instead of liver, for we have two kidneys and could pay that debt off in no time and still keep going. Anatomical donation authorization takes on a new interpretation here, doesn't it? These debt engagements, precipitating obligation upon the United States to the Crown of England, were recognized in the Constitution at Article 6, required by the contract between the King and the 13 United States of North America, signed at Versailles on July 16, 1782. And the contract between the King and the 13 United States of North America on February 25, 1783. Some would say these contracts were called a treaty of peace. If that is the case, then by definition, the country accepting such a named treaty is truly under an occupation. And so, since it has been, and shortly after, independence, we fell, bearing until today our cross under the occupation, equally bankrupt. With this, it appears the mere United States was formed with other than free people. Indentured subjects of the crown under servitude to a creditor because Congress failed to pay the prior debt. You figure that indicates Congress allowed you into voluntary servitude with the ratification of the Constitutional After Convention in 1789? Could the states actually have ratified a constitution with such a condition? Actually, the United States have been since before this a colony under corporate development authorized through letters patent issuing of the Crown of England in 1610, hence the colonies. Voluntary servitude is not illegal, but that was not within the authority of Congress or the states to accept as either a precondition in the birth of a free nation or its subsequent enslavement. Is that, you wonder, why the states are required to join the Union of an equal footing? You are sure it is. They and the people they represent must all agree to come in equally bankrupt. They also must give full faith and credit. We did this again in the various and continuing provisions of the New Deal for 1933 and hereafter. CHJR 192. We agree to share in the benefit of a welfare state. You continue this agreement by not stopping it. Isn't that interesting? Voluntary slavery. Working your life away for all what you do not understand, to line the pockets of the Esquire elite and corporate pirateering government. Apparently, you have been indoctrinated into the newer deal for the next millennium, the corporate collective consequence. Congratulations, conscientious crown comrade. It's so UN, that is to say, putting those two initials together, un-American. Not fit for human consumption unless you are a schleep. Now, who is left consuming this illusionary pee in a cup? Legal tender works only because you believe in it. Otherwise, it is, by law, worthless securities, USC 261-65-G2C. Legal policy or statute works only because you believe it is law. Otherwise, it provides worthless security. It's as money by as law. Remember, before you were to choose the pea in which cup, the confidence man secreted the pea into his private care. This is the eventuality of your money and therefore your law. It never really existed. You never really possessed them, nor could you. Do you still trust and play this confidence game? Have you bought into the con? Are you a schleep? Isn't it time to distrust and stand in your own right? Quote, it does not require a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority keen to set brush fires in people's minds, unquote, from Samuel Adams. What are you going to do about it? Who you gonna call? Try Ghost in the Mind Busters, 555 DMA tricks, waking those asleep. End of part 3 of Pee in a Cup by Antonio Bacci. Part 4 of Pee in a Cup by Antonio Bacci. End of part 4 of Pee in a Cup by Antonio Bacci. Part 5 and conclusion of Pee in a Cup by Antonio Bacci. Calm before our storm. But what about part 4? Part 4 was the part not written. The part giving time for silent contemplation. The things not said are as important as the things said, if not more so. Such as the silence between the notes in music. Did you become a schleep again, or rise up tearing through what preoccupies you? Your answer produces your intention. If you find the answer unsatisfactory, repent. Alternatively put, rethink, and choose ye this day whom you will serve, the creator or the creature. This part 5 is the snooze alarm for those asleep, or the gateless path for those early to rise wayfarers. The journey. We have made a research journey in the first 3 parts of this article, which expose a historically unprecedented occupation of a people causing the greatest debtor nation of all time, the United States. Are the words greatest and debtor in the same sentence oxymoronic? The answer lies in the context, intent, and purpose, such being the subject of our study. In our study also, we have exposed 3 adulterating elements which yoke the people with countless servitudes of unmentionable abomination. The naturalness of life, family, and righteous, actually creative, intentions have been supplanted by the very real, prevalent occupational corruptions of fabricated emergencies, foreign encroachment, and the erroneously stated, inexcusable, ignorance. It is time to return to divinity, our true destiny. Giving thanks. For those of you who have made it this far in our research journey, I am honored at your persistence and thank you for your audience. That persistence is extremely valuable if you intend to throw off what occupies you. I have had to compress, in a small space, very much knowledge, attempting a coherent communication. The knowledge and truths you now possess from this series of articles are just the start. As I have explained in the parts prior, if it is the will of the people, they must overthrow that which occupies them. This is a singular universal law which requires at this moment in time, and for all intents and purposes, has always mattered now. It is each our choice to restore ourselves to eternal truth of liberty or unlive, bound to the chains of dead corporate entities known as world government, its agents, officers, and employees. Look into the mirror. Can you see evil is live spelled backwards? And so is the global corporate collective consequence. A mirror of reality within which all shall surely exist as unlive corporates. Despite this virtual reality, we are thankful our only true task is, choose ye this day the mire or of the world or the light and the life. As a result of this article, I have had opportunity to meet with people who have expressed their agreement with the truths herein contained, and all have come to the same conclusion. What now? My answer? Yes, now. What is anything your divine spirit instructs? It is no holds barred when preserving self, but the scope of this article is too narrow to encompass the potential the people may intend now. That being the case, I will offer some suggestions as to where to start the restoration to the life we thought we were living, now known by us, revealed through the previous parts of this article, an illusion. Bar none now. I have suggested that the problems stem from our ignorance. Only the truth makes free is not a new revelation. What might be is that the bar associations and the International Bar Association, of which it is part, are providing the mechanism for the current, continuing defilement of an American way of life. This mechanism, which provides also for continuing ignorance, is of issue and must certainly be addressed. These parasitic corporate tortfeasor associations must be sent packing. Putting our head in the sand will not make this beast go away, nor will it provide an escape from the fact of our ignorance, which also will be in the sand, stuck. But those asleep dream this to be otherwise. Their nightmare? That they might wake up to the truth of their bondage. We must rise up if we are to experience the liberty intended through our divine spirit. We do not fear that which we do not know, for in what we do not know is destiny. We know what is best for our families and ourselves, and this must be preserved. Can we secure that by standing perfect and upright, abandoning our fallen nature and those presently of the world order? If we do not recognize and repudiate the pernicious bar, none will survive. Surely all is lost. The social organizers. The social engineers know us well. Quote, capital must protect itself in every way. Debts must be collected and loans and mortgages foreclosed as soon as possible. When through a process of law, the common people have lost their homes, they will be more tractable and more easily governed by the strong arm of the law applied by the central power of leading financiers. People without homes will not quarrel with their leaders. This is well known among our principal men now engaged in forming an imperialism of capitalism to govern the world. By dividing the people, we can get them to expend their energies in fighting over questions of no importance to us except as teachers of the common herd. Unquote. Taken from The Civil Servant's Yearbook, The Organizer, January 1934. The social engineers know more about us than this too. It is written, quote, westward the star of empire takes its way, unquote. The social engineers know the people are stubborn in their arrogance about what it is the people think they know. The engineers of society have all the proof they need of this fact. The fact that a social engineer can exist and flourish in a free society admits freedom's demise. We, the people, believe the people are in control, but it is equally apparent that we, the people, generally intend themselves ignorant and mediocre serfs. This is proved by the prevailing insistence of the people to believe they live in freedom, though they are the most imprisoned and taxed people on the planet, as has also been planned by the social organizers. Impotent Constitution. As seen in the preceding three parts of this essay, freedom or liberty have never been the law of the land. It can be clearly seen the Constitution isn't worth the parchment it is written on. It is impotent. Article 6 and the Treaty of Peace of 1782 proves this. The Declaration of Independence is just sugar-coated fikadu. The lack of substantive authority or demand within its four corners evidencing this. The New Deal being imposed upon our, what a joke, nation manifests sufficient proof of these truths. In actuality, the Constitution canceled due to lack of interest, yet the people stubbornly hold to their beliefs despite the facts. The people proving continually they'd rather choose to live an illusion under wager of bondage and the debt of prior obligation. Worthless security? To show the above statement true, one only needs to look and see that money is defined in law to be worthless security. Lack of specie shows the Constitution is worthless. The people commit to use the legal tender, called Federal Reserve Notes, evidence of debt, believing they pay as they go. This could not be further from the truth. And under this monetary policy other than law, when the government treasury buys back bonds, does the treasury use something of substance with which to pay? With what substance or specie does the government buy back its bonds, or put another way, obligations? And what does the treasury purport to buy back with more evidence of debt? The bond, or more aptly, the bondage. Because of this condition, prevailing logic holds. If the government used worthless securities, notes, promises to pay, to pay the bonds of prior monetary obligation of the people, then the bonds are not paid, and the people cannot be any less free of their bondage than from before the worthless so-called payment. The bondage continues without remedy into our future generations. Payment in legal tender means more and continuing bondage through obligation. This is the reason why the United States can never pay its debt. This will never, in any regard, relieve the continuing debt of obligation enumerated in the Constitution admitted upon its ratification. The ignorant, mediocre, apathetic stubbornness of the people keeps them blind to this truth. Though the people suffer exceedingly, they would rather remain asleep. Additionally, if there is nothing but thin air promise to pay with, what is the treasury for? Is it another cup with which to artificially contain the all-elusive pea? Do you think the Bunco manipulators of this little wager scheme have the beneficiaries and or the people, contestant gamblers, fooled? Can you see the answer to this whole illusion? Is that there really is no pea in a cup? The cup, merely a prop of the con artist bar members and the other elitist social organizers. If you can see any of this, you are no longer asleep, and time is now for the restoration. Destruction of the United States. These indeed are great times. It is quite amazing to witness the destruction of a nation firsthand. Unfortunately, it is the destruction of the United States of America. We had such potential. Is it all quite over? I think not. That I am able to write this multi-part article and you are yet free to read it brings the opportunity, even at this late date, to bring about the restoration. But time is growing short. As impossible, imposing, and ominous as the task at hand sounds, the answer is as simple as you. The moment you rise up with the intent to restore, the illusion disappears. The parasitic entity enterprise, P equaling bar association and or attorney, public, legal corporation, monopoly, can no longer fill the cup. Having no further game appeal, you are free to walk away from the corrupt table, no longer stunned by the spell in its magic cup. Your intent to restoration breaks the mirror and the illusion disappears. You are free and see the mystery of God is finished. When you see, you will know, being your proper position. At your perfect point, the current magnitude of reality dissolves before your eyes. All that is left is truth. The things of the world lose all significance, and those which believe themselves authority become the illusions they once promoted. You are not further persuaded by their magic, as it is inferior to your own inherent power and creation. And this is the answer to the question. In creation, there is no destruction, and the United States of America is indivisibly indestructible if you so will it. But it will take courage. Socially organized hysteria. Remember the prior statement taken from the civil servant's yearbook, The Organizer, January 1934? Specifically, quote, "By dividing the people, we can get them to expend their energies in fighting over questions of no importance to us," unquote. Think now of divisive emotional issues, and for an example, in this instance, of abortion rights. If people knew Roe versus Wade was a discussion concerning the underwriting liability to the government of the loss of a producing government property, the human resource of the mother, as compared to the loss of a future resource in a government property after delivery of a viable fetus, minus its investment to majority and potential yield, there would be no argument called abortion rights. People would be repulsed that their government considered they and their offspring property or chattel, not unlike those slaves prior to the Civil War. Since people will not educate themselves to the facts, they have missed the events which made them property owned by the government. A property to be worked and managed. A human resource. But as long as the people are focused on the fascists' organized hysterical illusion of abortion rights, and not the investment versus yield resource issue, the social organizers continue an unabated deception, and the people continue maintenance of the government futures and income property status as resource humans, managed for the highest yield, received by some invested yet undisclosed beneficiary interested principal. If you think that statement is far-fetched, then you must be made aware that there exists in the state of Oregon, all capital letters, a benchmark priority, quote, to yield a high return on human investment, including but not limited to greater worker productivity and future monetary savings, unquote. And, quote, two, the Legislative Assembly further finds that, A, Oregon's human resources constitute a major asset in the state's effort to promote economic expansion, unquote. Does that answer any remaining misunderstanding or disbelief about the human resource work camp construct in this free society? Does it answer why prison populations are rising though crime is falling? Does it follow then why it is the term human resource is being changed to, quote, human service, unquote? If these examples do not point to the actual applications, there needs then to be a check as to whether the one in disbelief, in light of these facts, is in socially organized hysteria. There is no fence straddling on this one, folks. Non-constitutional police state. As has been suggested earlier, awareness, a relief from the bliss of ignorance, is a wonderful place to start. To that end, let us look at a few more things here. I further suggest going back to the first three parts of Pea in a Cup, reading them for the multi-layered content and edification. Obtain a good legal dictionary and use it extensively. As mentioned previously, it can be clearly shown that we live in a policy and or police state and not otherwise. The term, quote, policy, polity, one, a judicial and executive system for the government of a city, town, or district for the preservation of rights, order, cleanliness, health, etc., and for the enforcement of the laws and prevention of crime, unquote. Notice closely the conjunctive term and, admitting that if you live under policy, you live under a governance denying the separation of powers of three branches of government. Also notice that a district is considered the appropriate situ for a non-constitutional police and or policy state. Which judicial district, water district, power district, or voter district do you reside, your non-constitutional situ? And what is prevention of crime? Is this an objective authority? In further study, you will find the answer is no. Policy, quote, two, that which concerns the order of the community, the internal regulation of a state, unquote. Whose order? Which state? Just for regulation? Under whose authority? Which objective basis? These words under this definition are not further defined and should be cause for great concern. Additionally, it can be shown that this word policy is closely tied in force, effect, and definition to the term confiscation. And is this of any surprise? In 1939, in his work, The New World Order, H.G. Wells wrote, quote, countless people will hate the New World Order and will die protesting against it. we have to bear in mind the distress of a generation or so malcontents, unquote. Early in the 1970s, Zbigniew Brzezinski, later Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, wrote, quote, "A global consciousness is for the first time beginning to manifest itself. We are witnessing the emergence of transnational elites, composed of international businessmen, scholars, professional men, and public officials. The ties of these new elites cut across national boundaries. Their perspectives are not confined by national traditions, and their interests are more functional than national." Unquote. The one force that can derail the rise of this new elite is the politically activated masses, whose nativism could work against the cosmopolitan elites. Unquote. Is ignorance really bliss? Does all this evidence not show that we have been living blissfully and ignorantly in a confiscated, non-constitutional, New World police state for a very long time? Permission to bear arms. Permission through license to carry versus the right to bear arms. Is this more divisive, socially organized hysteria? Permission. In opposition to what many are told, you don't need no stinking permission, license, or even constitution to bear arms. No law of the land requires permission of any sort to bear arms, just current, occupying, non-constitutional policy. So really, what's the debate? We are either an occupied people, free only upon privilege or revocable license with no rights whatsoever, or we can rely on necessity and objective law. In other words, what part of shall not be infringed can be misunderstood? Any protest proposing to question a necessity portends divisive, socially organized hysteria and external control. The militia is all of the people, all of the time, not just a few independent or select groups. Everyone inherits a right to bear arms antecedent any constitution. Unless you are chattel property, pursuant to the 14th Amendment, a public employee, or an alien enemy after the New Deal of 1933, you have the unalienable right to defense of self, period. This necessity comes naturally before government or its institutions. Contrary to popular belief, you owe no duty to the government. Government owes no duty to you, privately. You are not entitled to require the government to protect you. This does not dispense with the continuing necessity to preserve self and or family and or country. Hence, your unassailable right to bear arms, especially in a bathing suit. With the facts such as these, if you so choose, how can anyone lawfully question your necessity to bear arms? Only an amoral extremist bent on your future harm would impose such an unlawful burden as permissive privilege to bear arms. Incidentally, our choice of arms is not limited to guns. Would a tank and some rocket launchers do in exercise of your right? This enumerated necessity speaks to stopping government tyranny. Let us not now get embarrassed in exercise of this reasonable and prudent necessity. When government becomes unaccountable, as currently is the case, the right of the people to alter or abolish its treasonous corruption in any manner they see fit cannot be conditioned. This internationally recognized, inalienable capacity in all people is not in any governmental interest. It is, however, in a government's interest to cause an emotional collective consequence, implementing divisive social hysteria mechanisms, inducing in the people confusion, placing them off point and further asleep, and therefore ineffectual and defenseless. locked and loaded? Under escalating government-provoked crises, fostering oppression of our people, there will be an impetus to hasten revolution instead of restoration. This lack of patience can be seen in the oft-heard term lock and load. What part does the attitude of lock and load have in all of this? If you understand the purpose of the Second Amendment, you know the singular reason for it is to provide notice to those in government that they can expect the people to alter or abolish their governance as when they see fit, and in the use of arms is not prohibited when doing so. Notice arms is undefined in this famous charter. But did you know that this right of government abolition is merely a recognition under the law of nations? Every people, everywhere, in every time, have this antecedent right. Again, it is called necessity. This same necessity deprives all law of authority. Ask the fascist dictator Benito Mussolini about the right of the people to abolish government without a constitutional right. Oh, that's right. The people in Italy hung him and his cabinet. So you can't ask El Presidente, Il Duce, but you get the point here. The organized elitist promoting global order will insist you believe otherwise, to your irreparable harm. This brings us to those who, though they may intend well, are ready to discharge their duty under that Second Amendment right. The suspicion is, because of their delay, they are locked and intoxicatingly loaded. After reading all parts of Pea in a Cup, you will know that you are under a continuing occupation, some of which has been in effect since from before the beginning of the origination. Our lands have been invaded by an enemy. That is a fact. The enemy is entrenched parasitically in our lives. It is of concern that those who are ready to exercise their arms and Second Amendment right haven't already done so. What have they been waiting for? Do they know what the first salvo of salvation is? Is locked and loaded merely mock, inebriated vociferation? Child, the state's weapon of choice. This is where the government has chosen the child as its weapon of choice. In fact, those of the extremist fascist persuasion insist you are incapable of protecting your family without their help. As with the gun issue, the government shows over and over you are a threat to your own family. These government operatives also prove repeatedly that people will not protect their own from government-organized intrusion. Because of this, the social engineers, through the illusion called rights of child, so-called, can use your own offspring against you to gain more control of your family and ultimately your rights. Most will never ask what this child really is. Instead, they will adopt this ward of the state without further question as their own. This ignorance of the actual character of child will be their demise. Additionally, because of ignorance, they will not question but submit to juvenile courts of no lawful authority, never questioning how it is a natural son or daughter magically became child or juvenile in the state. Generally, under the onslaught, the people in their hypnotized slumber ask for more ineffective policies to protect them from themselves in the abandonment of their responsibilities so they may sleep a little longer. To solve this insanity, if your sons and daughters, as opposed to the state's child, were properly taught at home, there would be no hysteria, no government intrusion, if you know to say, go away, no lawful taxation, bondage, under a social engineer delusion, and no threat through division of your right of country and or family and or self-preservation. This requires, of course, that you awaken and take private responsibility of that which is yours, instructing yourself as to your prevailing authority, the judicial corruption, and the lack of any authority in public servants without your consent. But until then, do-gooders will magically appear at the gates bearing gifts and unwary parents. Do you really know what parent is? Will adopt this Trojan horse called Rights of Child, which is the weapon of choice for government-instigated hysteria contrived to separate you from yours, with your son or daughter the fodder, your family the fallout. Enough is enough. It would seem that taking this enemy out before its invading infestation would have been appropriate. So why haven't the Minutemen executed their right? Is it being kept for a rainy day? With the people under government terrorist guerrilla attack, certainly Waco, Ruby Ridge, Scott, the Bar Association, Family Services, Criminal Justice, the organized crime of corrupt government, police abuses, expedited property foreclosures, the national bankruptcy, and unaccountable public servants are rainy days enough to exercise right. If those in lock and load mode have not yet identified the enemy, I am not sure I want them to discharge duty now. There is a downpour of tyranny out here, and good people have failed to recognize this. If the locked and loaded cannot identify that enemy now among us, and having been so, then anyone could be mistaken for the enemy. If you have ever been hunting, you know the caution. Even if you know the buck is in the brush, make sure that's what you are shooting. Our problem is, if those who bear locked and loaded arms are asleep to the enemy among us now, how will they make sure their munition does not miss the mark when they finally decide enough is enough? To shoot in reaction to the influence of the preoccupying illusion is an irreparable mistake. But if not mystified, why the wait? Enough is enough. The question is not when to shoot, but what to shoot. The taunting occupiers leave you to shoot the wrong ammunition at the wrong target. Only the shot of truth heard round the world sets you free. Now, shoot or get in the melting pot. That great corporate melting pot of demo-inocracy. Alienate ignorance. Is another answer beginning to form? In Brzezinski's Remedy, will global consciousness fail if the cosmopolitan elite, globulins, be vanquished? Will all be forgotten after one rejected generation? I think not, and your world will rejoice in their passing. Action must occur now, not for the sake of the village and globularity, but for necessity's sake. And isn't it said that you are to be in the world, but not of the world? There is no need to be citizens of the world and of corporate governments. We have been granted a higher honor, that of the Creator. But this can only happen if you remember, ceasing division in yourself with the proper orientation. Alienate ignorance, turn toward the light of the sun. Another lesson found in this article, Pee in a Cup, is reflected in the following quotation. Quote, "What society thinks of as reality today is the hypnosis of social conditioning, an induced fiction in which we are all collectively participating. It is the melodrama of a humdrum existence filled with trite obsessions and trivial pursuits, wherein our only fate is to be born, grow old, and die. If we could realize it, the keys to the miracle of life lie in our own consciousness." Unquote. From Dr. Deepak Chopra. In the current reality, there never is a pee in a cup. Cease bunko bedazzlement by the government, public, servant, welfare recipient, purporting to give you a chance, law to win, protect the wager, you, the government investment and resource property. The win is nothing but a bad bet because the chance was never met before the wager, but to bind it. Your purpose. In the time between asleep and arisen and thereafter, it is imperative to express your new sight. We cannot let the shadows of this world occupy us any longer. We will make expression our works. There are others needing this example to shake them from being asleep. There is a remnant after truth currently charged in this task. In this truth, you are not alone. Seek them out. There is an expanding wave which radiates, and you are a part in your position. Your expression may come in any number of forms. For example, you might feel a need to carry a signboard publicly, a reciprocatingly enjoyable experience. There is also television, radio, newsletters, and newspapers, or websites like this one to express through. Most importantly, there is properly oriented fellowship with others. Love thy neighbor as thyself. This love is timeless and not merely the trite New Age conceptualization. Your action will radiate harmoniously with the others and does so as long as you are oriented correctly intending it. Do persist shining the light. This will not be something you learn. It will be at times difficult to maintain the task at hand. Most do not want to awaken. There is much resistance to change, but if we the people intend to live in truth, life, and liberty, change must happen. Almost as if back to the future, when virtue, honor, compassion, and respect ruled. This occurs when you are courageous enough to honor creativity and just do it, stopping the insanity by traveling the unconscious. In other words, in absence of the world. Victory, the restoration. This part 5 signals our victory under any evil occupation. The restoration to life everlasting starts when you wake, celebrating the death of this socially organized hysterical hypnosis. The restoration happens in the twinkling of an eye when you release your unsubstantiated beliefs of the world and its governments and their private laws which tempt and occupy you. The current false reality dissolves before your eyes. The mystery of God is finished. Do not eat of the fruit, and you shall not surely die. Come, let us stand then, perfect and upright. Take the walk, expressing, now, here I am. Remember, viva la restauración. End of part 5, and end of Pee in a Cup, parts 1 to 5 in its totality, by Antonio Vacci, 1999 AD. Read by Craig S. in the summer of 2024 AD, Montreal, Quebec, Canada.